Hello, this is a football fans podcast by the people behind CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady, and this week we have some very special guests from very far away.
Then sniffed me out like I was Tanqueray. Cause you're my fella, my guy. I'm your Stella and fly. By the time I'm out the door, you tear me down like Roger Moore.
The Champions League draw, I thought it'd be useful to have a chat about the finances at Celtic. Now, obviously, the most important thing about a football club is winning on the park, but what determines winning on the park is the amount of money in the bank. And the amount of money in the bank is determined by how much you can generate. So I thought it'd be useful to have a chat about, are we maxed out at our level, or could we do a wee bit more? Is there room for speculating to accumulate? Because obviously, no point in speculating if you then don't accumulate what you've speculated. So I wanted to look into that, particularly because the Champions League draw demonstrates more than anything else that you've got teams now who are playing at a certain level in Europe that puts their dominance ahead of their domestic rivals, which makes them win even more, which gets them more into Europe and blah blah blah. So, and you can see that the fact that we have drawn Astana again. So I thought I'd speak to some Celts who are doing very well for themselves in the Far East, people of influence in their particular sphere, to discuss the finance of Celtic. They are friends of mine, and they are now guys from the podcast. It's Robin and Alan, who chats through the finances of Celtic. And so I'll leave it up to them. Prior to that, just got the Arctic Monkeys for a cover version stuff, with the cover of the Amy Winehouse, You're No Good, and then David McAlmont with the cover of Diamonds Are Forever. So this is me, Harry Brady, passing over to Robin and Alan.
I'm in the tub, you're on the seat. Lick your lips while I soak my feet. Then you notice little carpet burns. My stomach drops and my guts churn. You shrug and it's the worst to truly stick the knife in first. I cheated myself.
I'm joined by Robin and Alan, who are far away Tims based in the Far East. Make you sound very mystic.
How you doing, Harry?
I'm excellent. I'm excellent, Alan. Robin, how are you?
Good, thanks, Harry. Thank you for having us on.
No problem. So before we do get you on, although I know your Celtic credentials, you need to set them out to our listeners. So, Alan, first up, first Celtic game, first Celtic hero.
First Celtic game, I still don't know why this game was played this day, but it was my first game. Was a New Year's Day game, big Glasgow derby, Celtic against Clyde in 1975.
Right.
Celtic won 5-1. I've no idea why we played Clyde. My dad used to take me to watch Hamlet and Achilles, so it was a bit of a treat going to Parkhead. All I remember actually sitting very high up in my mind and having Jimmy Johnson pointed out to me, who looked very, very small. I didn't really know what that meant, other than I seemed to be told they had some mythical qualities.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was my first game, and it was a team that still had sort of Jinky and Billy McNeil, but it had Danny and Doug Leash had come in, so it was in that sort of crossover period from the Lions to, you know, what came after.
Yeah, so the crossover period from reaching European finals to getting knocked out by Albanian teams, that crossover.
Exactly. Just at the tail end of the good bit.
Yes. And who was your first Celtic hero?
First Celtic hero, not one I'm especially proud of, but Charlie Nicholas, I think. As I say, I watched Hamilton as much as I watched Celtic in the 70s, so it was really when Charlie came in, I think, I was going regularly and standing in the jungle, and you know, Charlie was just unbelievable when he came in and scored all those goals and had that mullet that sort of somehow made me feel happy in the jungle. I don't care what I say about Charlie's mullet, actually.
You liked big hair, is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Ironically, when you see me now.
So, Robin, you've had time to think about it. First game, first Celtic hero.
Yeah, I can't absolutely recollect the first game. My first vivid memory of a game was the 73 Centenary Cup final, which obviously ended terribly badly. You know, the last of the massive crowds at Hampden, yeah. And the last of the drama. And, you know, I think that by extension of that, my first Celtic hero was Kenny Dalglish. I just worshipped, you know, everything. And we had a few years of him after that. But, you know, concurring with what Alan said, you know, Charlie Nicholas was a man of kind of my generation, and we just, you know, absolutely loved him to death. But I was more a sort of a late 70s, early 80s sort of fanatic, you know, when I really started going to games myself. But yep. I think, you know, you can't beat Dalglish. I mean, he was just fabulous.
I have minimal recollections of Dalglish in a Celtic jersey. Obviously just a wee bit younger than you guys. One of my earliest memories of the discussion of Dalglish's mom calling me out of the garden because the European Cup final was about to start when he scored for Liverpool.
I appreciated the premise of that book last year, but was it last year it came out about Dalglish and his Celtic
St. Anthony's book,
That had kind of, intellectually I sort of knew that, but it hadn't really landed with me that he'd been there for so long and had done so much. I mean, really the first thing, I remember him being good and I remember being devastated about him leaving, but yeah, I hadn't actually realised until St. Anthony wrote it, you know, how much he'd actually achieved at the club.
Yeah, because, I mean, his whole career, the whole narrative of his career has moved on to his Liverpool days and sort of bypassing the Celtic period. I also grew up in a period where my memory was Scotland fans bemoaning Kenny Dalglish. Yeah. He never played as well for Scotland as he did for Celtic and then Liverpool.
I do remember that. I remember being at I suppose the opposition probably wasn't at Quinson's, but I remember being at a Scotland-Northern Ireland game. And being sort of baffled, I don't know what age it would have been, 9 or 10 or something, being baffled by the reaction. I don't vividly remember him being booed, but you know, as soon as he made a mistake, he was going to load a stick from Scotland fans. I remember sort of not quite getting that at the time, and then learning later what it was all about.
Yeah. So we're recording this the morning after the night before, or the night after the morning before for you guys in the Far East. Did you get to see the game last night, Robin?
Yes, we watched it in my office at 7 a.m. this morning, delayed live. I'm happy to say that the feed from Celtic TV for once was adequate. I'm also happy to say that when we logged in, they gave us an option of not knowing the score, which they've not always done, having gone video silent overnight. It was a great result. We were somewhat apprehensive at the start. You know, you never really know how these games are going to go. Our away record, as we know, has been abominable. But I think on balance, looking back in it now and having read the press overnight, morning our time, we were reasonably comfortable throughout.
Yeah, Alan?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those games. I mean, I find when I look back on the qualifying rounds, I often remember actually very little of the games. It's all about the result, right? I thought we were really poor in the first leg, and I thought we were a bit better last night. But really, just delighted to get through it. I said to Robin just after half time, more than anything, I really hoped it didn't go to extra time because I couldn't really be bothered watching another half an hour of it. But I can't remember. So I saw a comment today about Forrest's goal, I can't remember what it was, saying, you know, it was two bad touches and a handball before he sort of battered it in off the crossbar. So yeah. Was very, very happy to see it good. And I thought his second effort and goal was much more like what I was expecting from Forrest. But fair play, cracking goal, just all of it getting through, really.
My daughter could have done better than he did on that second attempt. I mean, what was he thinking? You know, you saw it from behind the goal and all he had to do was hit it into the corner. And he just stayed fright. I mean, that's just... He's almost the kind of player that if you have to make him think, he's just going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that. The only thing I have in common with James Forrest, I think, as a footballer, is the more time I'm given to think, especially in front of goal, the worse the outcome, right? How that went down for the second one was best case for what I'd have done, but,
I suppose he's looking there thinking, I've only got the keeper to beat. If I take a shot, which I said in the podcast with Mark Cooper last night, I think after his second touch, he should have just hit it for the one where he tried to end the keeper. And as you say, Robin, from behind the goals, it's fairly obvious that actually if he just hit it down low, it would have gone in. But I don't know whether the too much thought thing is thinking, if I hit this, people will say, why didn't you just round the goalkeeper?
I think he was also maybe wondering if he was offside, just because it had all sort of the play had broken down and then suddenly it had come back to me. He was clean through. I think it was maybe just one of those where he had a moment sort of half waiting for a
if I'm not prepared to be that kind. I mean, you've been too listen, I think that we've got to view last night's game, you know, in context. Last night's game was purely financial in terms of its implications. You know, and my back of a fag packet, so I've got, last night's game was a €10 million game, Harry.
Yeah.
And, you know, the breakdown of that is that you get €3 million for getting into the final qualification round of the Champions League. You get about four million or so for being, in the Europa League, which we now are guaranteed of, and you get three home games that will probably produce something in the region of about, you know, £3 million, £1 million a game. So, you know, last night was a €10 million, £8-9 million game. And in the context of Celtic season, you know, that's very significant. You know, it probably doesn't have the implication of triggering bonuses or any of that sort of stuff, which we know getting into the group stage as well. But that's a very significant game for us at this start, at this stage of the season, and therefore it was a highly satisfactory outcome.
Well, so one of the things about the Champions League and the relevance of getting through, if you look at the teams that we can get in the next round, they are the same. They are Karabag, Astana, Hapoel Beersheva, Slavia Prague, and I'm sure there's one other.
Croatian team, right?
Yeah. But three of those we've had in the last three seasons. The point being, what you're starting to find in Europe is that €10 million windfall you just talk about, Robin, then just keeps a self-perpetuating process for the teams at the top. So we are up to £40 million better than anybody else in Scottish football because we played Champions League last season, which then means that we will win the league this season, which then means we will get Champions League football. And that you're seeing that repeated now across Europe, where the same teams are getting that windfall bonus that just makes them better than everybody else to then carry them through. So that leads to part of the reason why you guys are in the podcast. I mean, obviously, it's about winning things, but let's be honest, in the modern football world, it's also about money. So we seem to be hitting a ceiling of somewhere in the region of the ballpark of £90 million is our ceiling. And with that ceiling, it's really difficult for us to do better than third place or second place in the Champions League. If we get second place in the Champions League, one last 16 and then punted out. Do you guys see that there's a way that we could break through that £90-100 million barrier and get more money out of what we've got as it is? Alan, what are your thoughts?
I think the first thing worth sort of thinking about is just the context of that 90 million. I mean, you're saying 90 off the back of we announced half year revenue of 60 million this year, 61 million, right? And I think you're right. I think you extrapolate that for a full year, you probably get to about 90 million. I mean, to keep that in context, that'll already be based on a little bit of research that I quickly did. I think that's about £15 million more than Celtic will ever have made in a season. You know, the highest revenue seasons have been, and there's been a few of them, have all been kind of around about £75 million. So I think the first thing that's worth remembering about that 90 million is it's bloody hard to even get there. You know, I look back, I mean, even the Seville season, which surprised me actually. Seville season, that the revenue was £69 million, and then we, you know, as I say, we made £75 million 2007 to 2009, when we were got to the last 16 a couple of times, and then 2013. So, you know, to get to £90 million, I think the board and management of the club have already done an incredibly good job within the construct of the domestic game that we're in. I had a quick look. I mean, I think one of the avenues this conversation inevitably goes down is the pros and cons of whether Celtic would like to play in English football and what the financial implications of that would be. But just as a reference point, the Deloitte do a report on the top 20 clubs in Europe, as you know, every year, and the English clubs which get into the Deloitte report make revenue of in the season I looked at, between 170 million up to about nearly 700 if you're Man U. But the batch of clubs that aren't in there, there's Newcastle and Everton have revenue of £125 million. Sunderland 108, Swansea and Watford, this is before the new TV deal, have revenue of about £97-94 million. So in the English context, even with TV money under the old TV deal, the clubs like Watford, Swansea, here at the bottom end of the Premiership, are only making a little bit more in revenue than Celtic are. So I think my first answer to that question is that it's incredibly difficult for Celtic to break out of the range that they're in while they're playing in Scottish football, because your sort of level of European success is going to be to a large extent constrained by your domestic league, right? Mm-hmm. So we can debate how far Celtic could go in Europe, but if you're in Scotland, I think it's very difficult to start earning more than that. Robin, of course, is much more optimistic about life than I am, so let him comment.
I am more optimistic, but I would say the short answer to your question, Harry, is no.
Right.
You know, 90 is absolute record financial performance, if indeed it turns out to be that. But 90 represents last group stages in the Champions League with a new Champions League TV deal. It represents two cup final victories, two old fun games in semi-finals, a record number of home games because of the way that the cup draws were played out. So 90 in the context of the current business model is pretty much operating capacity. Mm-hmm. And there is very, and furthermore, 90 includes the Lisbon bonanza, which kicked in sort of mid-May.
Yep.
Though I don't have any detail, I would imagine that May and June would have been absolute record months for retail, and indeed any additional payments from New Balance or relating to the number of shirts sold and what have you, that will be in that 90. So I think that what are the factors that could affect the 90? Well, if you look at the domestic season, we could have drawn Rangers in a home quarter final, yeah, as opposed to semi final, and that would have added, maybe a net million quid onto the bottom line, and we could have got them twice. But I mean, that just doesn't happen. The big factor is, can we firstly replicate this level of success, but secondly, can we get into the last 16? And the impact of getting into the last 16 net would probably be about 6 or 7 million quid to us. Mm-hmm. Because you've got to remember that there will probably be a whole series of bonus payments.
Yep.
Will need to be paid to the manager, to some of the players, to all of the people who've got their their hands in the trough. And so even in the context of getting to the last 16, which I think we all recognise would be a magnificent achievement and possibly not realistic this time, but maybe next time, but even that's only going to take you up to 95, 96, maybe 97. To give you a parallel, we would have to get to the semi-finals of the Europa League to replicate that kind of money. So we are pretty close in the current business model to absolute operating capacity. And I think that, you know, I concur with Alan's comments about, you know, the management of the club. We may not all agree with some of the decisions that they have made, mm-hmm. you know, but from a business sense, we absolutely have become the powerhouse of Scottish football and have got a seat at the bigger table. You know, not the absolute big table, but the bigger table. And I think that's the best that we can hope for.
See, I have made my name on this podcast for being a prudent person who talks about spending within your means, and particularly during the Murray years when the press were telling us that we should splash the cash. And I'm always wary of, you need to work out what your maximum earning potential is before you decide how much you're going to spend, because there's no point in Celtic going out and buying £3-10 million players to get us in the last 16 if the last 16 is only going to net us an additional £6 million over where we are, because you're then £24 million worse off.
I think the other thing that last night reminds us is the fragility of the business model, right? I mean, if we, God forbid, Jamesy, hadn't sort of bashed that ball in the top of the net and we'd gone out last night, you know, then you're looking at a Europa League qualifier. You know, to my original point, it is a very fragile business model, even to get, you know, the Champions League money at the current time. You know, and then when you start to think about what sponsors we have attracted and you know, what sponsors we could attract. I mean, I know that the club does go through a very thorough process of, you know, looking by sector and looking at industries and look, you know, looking at all the potential partners that they identify. So the question there is, you know, what would it take to go from the amounts of money that we get from companies like Magners or Daffabet? You know, what would have to happen for, you know, somebody to want to give us £10 million, £20 million, you know, to attract a global brand or, you know, a very big national brand. And you know, that sort of takes you back to that, where are you playing? You know, I think the single only practical way that Celtic's turnover could materially change and both through sponsorship and you know, TV, would be if there was a route into playing in England. Now, I know that we've all discussed this for years and, you know, we've all got reviews on it, so setting aside for a minute the practicalities of it, I just don't see, even if you think about the infamous North Atlantic League, you know, even if we were playing games against Porto and Ajax and, you know, whoever else it would be, Feyenoord and Rosenborg potentially, you know, I'm not too sure that would really create an enormous additional amount of commercial appeal. So to me, it's almost a bit of an elephant in the room these days, because we've talked about it for so long and not got anywhere. But it's really only by somehow tapping into the money that's in English football that I can see Celtic breaking out of the parameters that they're currently in.
Well, if UEFA won't let us go and play in cross-border competitions at all, whether it's Atlantic League or playing in England, do you think we are... So then, one of the challenges we've got, you talked about the £75 million quid sort of 10 years ago. Problem is, football inflation is massively outstripping other forms of inflation. So the quality of player that you can get on a £75 million turnover is not the same as what you could have got in a £75 million turnover 10 years ago. So is there a way that we can just incrementally push and get an extra million here and an extra million there? Are we underselling our brand on a worldwide basis?
Absolutely not. And this, there isn't a football club in the world that doesn't think that they've got some kind of global appeal, and that there is a fan base in Japan, you know, in Korea, and in Mexico, and in South Africa, and in Canada, and so on and so forth. We, you know, as unique as we may be in terms of our history and our value set, our appeal, you know, is limited to the Scottish and Irish diaspora, with the occasional foray into, you know, a successful international player, Nakamura, you know, being the sort of the best case in point.
Yeah.
And for a limited period, there was some following in Japan, and I think at the time, you know, the club had a limited Japanese language website, and they sold a few shirts. But I'd be surprised if they sold 1,000 shirts in Tokyo, you know, to put it into context.
Yeah.
So I think you know, in that respect, you really are just playing with the margins and you're not generating significant additional revenue. The opportunity, and I'll put my dreamer cap on here, is that we think big. And I think I'll use the kind of the Google scenario here, Harry, where, you know, going back to the magic Barcelona nights, you know, if we had got Jerry Yang and Eric Schmidt on the Google jet, you know, into Celtic Park or into Glasgow Airport, helicoptered them into Celtic Park, you know, stuck them down next to Rod Stewart, you know, the pre-match, the game, the atmosphere, you know, the magic that was in the air that night that, you know, frankly, isn't often replicated.
Yeah.
But then you represent to them, okay, there is something unique here. We're not entirely sure how we need to package it, but you can help do that. But there is something here that you can make available, and you can make it part of your brand. You know, and then I think when you go into the, you know, the context of Google, where you're talking about access to, you know, wealth beyond anybody's imagination, there is possibly scope to that. But there are a number of limiting factors, you know, and two immediately spring to mind. Firstly is the absence of global coverage of Scottish football.
Yep.
You know, so effectively you're limited by six Champions League games, you know, two of which are probably going to be against another Diddy, two of which might be against somebody quite good, and two might be against an A-lister. So you've got very, very limited coverage on a global basis, and even where there is coverage, I'm not sure how many people are interested. But then secondly, you know, and I'm in delicate territory here, you've got the, you know, what corporate appeal is there to the fan base and the recent publicity, you know, surrounding the Green Brigade and, you know, the IRA associations? What corporate appeal is there, you know, when we were playing the Israelis last year and people are flying Hamas flags? What corporate appeal is there regarding this ridiculous, abominable behaviour in Sunderland by some idiots? Who may or may not be Celtic fans, but the reality is they're filmed wearing a Celtic strip on the day of a game.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are, our corporate appeal is limited to a degree by the fan base and the unfortunate tiny component of it who attract a significant amount of attention.
But isn't that then the dilemma? Because the very thing that you've just identified that would appeal to the corporates, fly them into any Champions League game, the stadium's bouncing, the tifos that are being created, the atmosphere at a level that you're just not, that's becoming too gentrified in other circumstances and other grounds, and people come in and say, this is real football, this is what I want, this is blood, guts and passion, this is everything that I could sell, is created by the very people that you've just identified have something that a corporate wouldn't want to be associated with. Isn't that the challenge? Isn't that a bit of a problem?
Well, that is the conundrum. You know, I think Celtic got a lot of criticism for closing the section for two games, and you know, I think you can debate the rights and wrongs of that. But you know, I think if I put myself in their shoes, that there must be just a phenomenal level of frustration within the club, as you say, that you know the Green Brigade have brought passion back. I mean, you remember what the atmosphere was like, you know, before they brought it back. And
yep.
You know, I think the club has sort of taken steps at times to embrace it. But then you know that there are also times, and I think this was one where, you know, whatever the other thoughts were at Celtic Park, I'm pretty certain that there was a view that we had better get in and deal with that before the situation was taken out of our hands. Now, I don't think, you know, could we have done it another way rather than, you know, stopping 900 people from coming into the game? Possibly. But, you know, I think that is the conundrum. And you know, even when you talk about the, you know, we're reflecting there on the appeal to sponsors, but, you know, even when you think about the you know, to my earlier point, English football administrators sort of thinking about the pros and cons of Celtic, or even English clubs. You know, you can just sort of imagine the whoever, you know, the English Defence League, or you know, whatever you want to call them. you know, picking out six or eight Celtic away games and, you know, sort of targeting them. So, you know, as we parade the RA songbook up and down the length of England and, you know, the local sort of right-wing thugs turn up to have a go, you know, it would be, it could be unpleasant. You know, Robin and I were talking this morning, we were both at Celtic-Chelsea at Stamford Bridge for a friendly, I can't remember, maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it was a taste of what it was like. It was comical. I was there with a very posh mate of mine from London who's a Chelsea fan who was in the Celtic end with me, and we were in his flat beforehand, and he had his shirt on, and I sort of said to him, you know, you might want to put a jumper on top of that, and he sort of said, oh, you know, there's never see any trouble at Stamford Bridge. You know, fast forward 2 hours and we're coming out and it's like a scene from, you know, fucking 24 or something, right? We're all sort of kept in for half an hour and there's dogs and vans, and in my memory there was a helicopter. I don't even know if there was a helicopter or not. And I turned away from the main Celtic sport because I was actually going back to my mate's flat afterwards. I walked past this pub where they'd sort of closed the Chelsea fans in, you know, and there was guys with their hands out the window with a bottle sort of trying to chuck it, and if they could only move their wrist, it was like a badminton shot. So there was bottles kind of crashing 5 feet out, and so you know, I think that's right. I think that is absolutely the conundrum for the club, and that's why I do have, you know, I'm very sensitive to the argument that there's a lot of kind of slightly hypocritical Celtic fans of roughly my own age, you know, who you know, hark back to days in the jungle in the 80s and, you know, how fantastic it was. You know, I remember Charlie Nicholas, and I also remember what was being sung and shouted around me and what has been collected in buckets as I left the game. And so, you know, so I absolutely would love to see the Green Brigades prosper. But there's a sweet spot that I don't think the Green Brigade have been willing to come to, and I don't think the club are able to get to at the moment. And, you know, there's a few things like that, which all taken together, just lead to that feeling of, that you know, to Robin's point, the Google executives might not quite yet be writing a cheque for £50 million for us.
I see your point about the Green Brigade. I always think of comedians who want to be on the edge, someone like Russell Brand or Frankie Boyle or something like that. The nature of being on the edge means occasionally you will overstep the mark and get it completely wrong. And that's where I see the Green Brigade. They're, obviously, the nature of being an ultra, you're not just going to turn up and sing, you know, we've got Jimmy Johnson on the wing or anything like that. You're wanting to prove your ultra credentials and always push things to the limit. And occasionally you will get it wrong. And from my understanding, there are people within the Green Brigade who think they got it wrong with the banner against Linfield, and there are other people within the Green Brigade who think, no, that's what we just got to do every so often.
There's a great comment I saw on Twitter. I can't remember who it was that said it in Twitter, but they said the Green Brigade, they're like your wee brother, you know, who's just always going that wee bit too far, but you still love him.
Well, and you ought to view this in context, though. We're talking about a level of global sponsorship, you know, in a world driven by political correctness that is now at an extreme level. You know, a reasonably vitriolic Scottish press, a terribly vitriolic English press, which is much more far-reaching than the Scottish press. And you have to say that, okay, if you want to, you know, the Google scenario is that there needs to be compromises if the club wants to have an appeal into that type of corporate partner. You know, and I think that the best illustration of that is if you look who the current corporate partners are. You know, and we have got a kind of second tier Asian-based online bookie and gambling website. You know, we've got a Glasgow-based, very successful booze manufacturer and distributor, and those are the principal corporate sponsors. You know, so we're not even, you know, forget about Google. Let's say you were going to look at Standard Life, you know, I mean, who I think are Scotland's biggest company.
Yeah.
And, you know, so what's okay? So Celtic are Scottish football. We are the only component of Scotland that is represented internationally. And why would Standard Life want to be associated with us? Now, they're probably paying Andy Murray £20 million a year away of their badge and his shirt and turn up for their corporate days. But, you know, he's very much within that PC world. We are not in that PC world. So it's very difficult to imagine that somebody like that would be interested in being associated with us.
Yeah, interesting point there you make, just touching on about Andy Murray turning up at a corporate event, because I know that's also motor racing. Those people who get the first and second tier corporate sponsorship, one of the things you've got is you've got your sportsman has got to turn up at their corporate events, golf events, golfers turn up at their event, motor racing turn up at their event, Andy Murray turn up at the event. And as part of the challenge then for us to move into that second or first tier of corporate, that we would need to buy a quality of player. No, I think Scott Brown's great. He was my number one in the Celtic Underground top 10. But they're not going to know who Scott Brown is when he turns up at a corporate event.
Well, there is also something in the UK with the profile of the sport there, right? I mean, you know, Rob and I both work for organisations that, you know, will provide sponsorship to rugby. They will provide sponsorship to golf. But, you know, increasingly over the last 10 years, as football has become gentrified at the Chelsea and Arsenals of this world, you know, they're taking contacts along every week to football matches in England now. So, you know, football entertaining is a big part of corporate sponsorship now, if you want to call it sponsorship. But there's a big difference between wanting to put your name on a football team shirt and taking people along to the game. So I think that in some ways the football product has improved, but in some ways it's still, you know, I think when it comes to big business in the UK, and I don't think this is necessarily the same in every country, but you know, it's still the sort of the Green Brigade factor, if you want to call it that, is a football factor, right? You know, you don't need to worry about sponsoring a rugby team and finding somebody, you know, having a paramilitary banner at one end of the ground. It's less likely. I don't recall seeing that at Murray Field in the telly.
Do you know one thing I did when we played at Murray Field? One of the things I thought was awful. I was sitting on the other side of the stadium. The disabled section was called the wooden spoon section. I couldn't believe it. I honestly couldn't believe it. It was called the wooden spoon section. Disabled section, the wooden spoon section. Couldn't believe it. In addition to the fact that they also serve alcohol, but had that all covered up because the dirty down market football fans had come to town. You know, that was the other aspect of it. Getting back to your point, though, that's your point. I mean, without sounding too political about it, it's a class thing, and for some reason, that's not replicated elsewhere. And you can see that by the fact there's money in the UK, there's lots of people with money in the UK, but the money that's going into football in the UK is by foreigners, it's not by British money.
I think it's more than a class thing, Harry. I think that, listen, Rangers in their glory period, and I use that word referring very much to old co, let's just be clear, but in their glory period they managed through the kind of the Lawrence Marlborough, you know, the era of the 70s and the early 80s, you know, they had a certain corporate appeal because they were the Scottish establishment, but it was very much in a Scottish sense. And I think that when Murray, you know, came in and sort of engineered his, you know, financial doping and all the other stuff, what he did was he did create a certain appeal. But that was, you got to remember the players that they had, and they did sign a whole bunch of England internationals. So that in itself, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think that with Celtic, there has always been this perception that you know, we are outside of that west of Scotland, you know, sort of core establishment. And therefore, we don't benefit from that support, you know, financially, and we don't have an appeal into that community. And you know, that's one of the reasons why we are. And of course, the irony to this is that we have become the west of Scotland establishment, and that we are completely dominant, and we do have a significant influence over the SFA, and we are over half of the Scotland team. So, you know, we've kind of won that argument.
Yeah, but we are the establishment of Scottish football. But getting back to your point, You know, there's you two, high profiles or well established in your business as Celtic fans, not in Scotland. If I was to go and speak to your equivalent in Scotland, well, I had a he's now retired from PwC because the age threshold thing, but Frank Blynn, he would be the equivalent of you guys in Scotland, and he wouldn't be going to Celtic Park.
No.
So the establishment of the business community is still perhaps Rangers orientated.
Yeah, although, but I think the positive way of looking at that is, I mean, there is only one major football team in Scotland now. You know, it has been for a few years, and it's likely to remain that way for a few years. And I think that when you ask the question as to how Celtic could expand their revenue, could expand the business, I don't even think about the Glasgow business community. Only because I don't actually think, you know, given all the issues around the Scottish economy, all the rest of it, I don't think there is a massive pool of sponsorship money really there. Anyway, I think you have to. I think if Celtic are to expand, they would naturally be looking outside of the bubble that is the west of Scotland anyway. Well, I just think financially, if you're, you know, I think it probably has been the case. If you're Peter Lawle, you know, the top thing on your want-to-do list every day for the last 10 years has been, you know, figure out a way to tap into the English football money. And again, you know, going back to those figures that I quoted initially, I sort of, even that becomes questionable, right? If there's, you know, we would obviously like to think of ourselves as being in the top end of the English Premiership, but it would take a bit of time, right? But when you see that the club, you know, clubs in the bottom half, even a club like Everton that probably has, you know, would see itself as having some level of similarity, a club like Newcastle, you know, they're established Premiership teams, and they've got revenue of sort of, you know, £120 million. So, you know, even that arguably is not a sort of a real breakout for Celtic, right? And so, yeah. You know, as a fan, you know, do I want to go from a £90 million club to a £120 million club to play, you know, against Watford and Birmingham and Swansea, as opposed to SPL? Yes, but SPL plus Champions League every season. No, it becomes debatable, right?
Yeah, so you're pretty much saying, because one of the things that sort of prompted me to also think about this, because we chatted about this before, was the guy Stephen Curry. I know I'm not a basketball fan, who has made the big deal in America about the amount of money he's earned in basketball, and I was listening to the fact that actually he had made a difference, he had generated X more pounds for them, and therefore the investment of going out and getting that type of player made it worthwhile. And it did then make me think, well, is it actually worthwhile then for Celtic to go out and buy one or two, change your price threshold for what we're looking at, go out and buy one or two bigger players to see if that can eke out the difference between us earning 90 million to 100 million? Is it worthwhile speculating to accumulate, or are we maxed out?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, because if you broaden our comparisons outside of England, and I want to come back and talk about that, because that is a bubble that will burst, but that's another subject that we can come to in a minute. You know, you look at Celta Vigo, you look at Seville, you look at Porto, you know, possibly even Benfica, you look at Bal, you look at Anderlecht, you look at Ajax, you look at those types of places. The advantage that they all have, and I think their businesses of a similar size, to say, maybe FC Bal is a little bit smaller, Celta Vega is possibly a little bit smaller, but the advantage that they've got is that they are selling players for significantly greater money than we are. You know, Seville are selling guys for 30-40 million euros. And that feeds the gravy train, allows them to buy more. But certainly in Spain and Portugal, fractional ownership is permitted. You know, so the clubs are not technically getting all of that money. Mm-hmm. You know, they're effectively creating a platform for the player and benefiting to a degree. And Ajax get knocked out last night by Nice in the qualifying for the Champions League.
You did your research. You said before we came on, you'd done no research.
I don't know what happened to FC Bal. I don't know what happened to Anderlecht. I don't remember if they're even in it. So, you know, I think that, you know, in that terms, you know, we're doing okay. But the trouble is, Harry, that, you know, where does the money come from? You know, if you're a business that is generating 90 million in cash, and we are effectively spending, you know, I think from information publicly available, you know, at the end of the season, when you've paid all your bills, forget about profit, because profit's irrelevant for football clubs because it's a subject of financial engineering. But I think that we had probably somewhere in the region of about 10 million quid left in the bank. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, at the beginning of the season, we had about 5 million quid left in the bank. Mm-hmm. So net to the club, we've generated 5 million in cash there or thereabouts that is available for future investment. But you've got to remember, we've got an ageing stadium that requires investment. We have relayed a pitch at some considerable cost. We spend money in Lennox Town. You know, the various infrastructure related, you know, the club's got quite a big payroll, both playing and non-paying staff. So we just don't have the money. Now, we obviously have the ability to borrow the money, but you then, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, well, you only have your first, you know, smoke of crack, and then you quite like it. Then, you know, before you know, you're doing it every other week.
Speak for yourself.
Well, Tom, you know, we are in the Far East. You've got to live by your means. And I think that the coming back to Alan's point earlier on, where the fragility of the business model, you know, and the fact that probably a third of our turnover relates to success of these games in August and the outcome thereof, it is incredibly difficult then to say, okay, we're currently buying players in the 3 to 4 million bracket, and even that is pushing the boat out. Mm-hmm. You know, if we were to start spending 10 million, you know, I mean, Andy Robertson, I think, is a good example of that. Of, you know, he's a decent young player, but he's not better than Kieran. He's not better than Tierney.
No.
That's because Tierney's world class.
But I mean, to move the needle, we just have to go so massive, and we just don't have the money to do that. You know,
but I would argue that is broadly the approach we're following at the moment, right? On a small scale, I mean, the wage structure, I believe, was flexed, shall we say, to bring in Dembele and Sinclair last year. You know, more money. We all know we can, you know, whether it was caused by bottles of champagne in the director's box or not. You know, more money was made available to bring in a manager and a backroom team and, you know, a couple of players. And you know, we I mean, from the little I know, is how the club operates. You know, I think we have got to 90 million. Turnover by, you know, people bursting their balls and all the small things. You know, they've done everything they can in merchandising. They've contacted every bloody, you know, brand partner they can think of, and they together with a, you know, friendly principal shareholder, I guess, you know, they have generated some extra cash to bring in bigger name players, and you know, I think we'll find. Setting aside what would have happened if we'd lost last night, I mean, if that generates success, if we, you know, we continue getting decent Champions League success, and or if we get some Champions League success, and if we, you know, keep moving towards 10 in a row, I think we can look to make those incremental improvements. But, you know, to your initial opening question, it's not going to sort of move us from 90 million to 100. But, you know, I think it has proven that the approach that Celtic have taken to managing the ship carefully, and now opening the purse strings a little bit, because they're, you know, for various reasons, 10 in a row in the horizon, whatever else, I think that model has been proven to be the right one, and I just don't think anyone's going to come along and, you know, decide that we should spend 10, 12 million pounds on a player, because then you lose to Rosenberg and it's, you know, back to 60 million pound turnover.
Yeah, and you got a 30 million pound black hole because your plan's based around a 90 million turnover. The one thing, over the last 15 years, we've principally had this core business model, and we've tweaked how we're going to do it. One of the biggest tweaks was Ronnie Dyla going down the route of, well, we've been recruiting players who are projects that we then develop up. Maybe we could recruit a manager who's a project that we then develop up. And for me, what the last 15, 16 years of this model has demonstrated is that the key person that we can afford to splash most out on is the manager. Because during that time, Martin O'Neill, Neil Lennon, Gordon Strachan, well, Martin O'Neill, Gordon Strachan, Tony Mowbray, Neil Lennon, Ronnie Dyla, Brendan Rodgers, during that six, the period when we've motored on a combination of turnover and feel good has been when we've had the big moneyed manager. Although, again, you could argue Strachan got us the last 16 and that you talked about the £75 million a year. But in terms of, because I think football isn't just judged on and can't be just judged on money, because that's just nonsense. Football's judged on success, feel good of the fans, and in modern football it's then judged on what money you do. And it was under Martin O'Neill and now under Brendan Rodgers that we've had the best combination of those factors.
There's a stat, Harry, that shows that I think that in the one of the Martin O'Neill years, our payroll was bigger than Bayern Munich.
Right.
So, I mean, that puts it into context. Now, I don't know what Bayern Munich's turnover was at then, and, you know, German football, you know, was probably much smaller than it is now. But I think that, you know, we lose sight of the fact that, you know, who are the fan base? Who's paying that 90 million? Where's it coming from? And the fan base is the west of Scotland, you know, then the rest of Scotland, and then Ireland. You know, those, and I think that, you know, in terms of our core constituency, revenue is maxed out. You know, my personal view is not being a season ticket holder, but paying to go to games and paying handsomely to do so when I'm back in Glasgow, is that season books are too cheap. Apparently, the average is about 350 quid a head. And you know, that's way too cheap. But the, you know, the club has obviously done extensive research in terms of what people will pay for the product that is on the park. You know, the Champions League package last year was 129 quid for the three games, and three good games. I think that was also too cheap. But that's probably and the previous year. No, sorry, I think the 129 quid, I'm not entirely sure that they sold out of those until the very last minute. We did sell out, but I mean, it wasn't a question of them, you know, rushing out the door and every season book holder took his ticket. So I think that you've got to, you know, you've got to look at your core constituency, and the core constituency supports Celtic to the level that it's at, where we have generated this degree of success. But you're just not going to get any more money out of that for fan base.
Yeah, I understand the sort of rough of our fan base is it's 35-year-old male who earns just underneath the average wage in the UK. That's our average supporter. So it's really difficult to ask our average supporter to pay an extra £200 a year in the season book, which would make that would be one of the things that would push us to, you know, pushing up an extra 5 million quid or whatever it would be.
Which again, you know, makes the point that £90 million turnover for that business is phenomenal, right? I mean, you're probably closer to me than what the other Scottish clubs are doing. I mean, that's a data point we didn't cover, but, you know, my understanding is a club like Dundee's probably get turnover of 5 million, something like that.
I think Aberdeen might be eight. And Rangers, Rangers will be, I think Rangers will be 28 or something like that.
I pulled out the video. Rangers were 23 million in the year ended 16, so I guess there'll be a bit more last year. But you know, so for Celtic to, for, you know, ignoring for a business in the same industry, for, you know, for the same demographics of support, to be able to get £90 million out of the business is phenomenal. And, you know, it's easier for us all to sit around and go, that Law's an idiot, and, you know, we should be like Everton. You know, we're a bigger club than Everton. But, you know, I've asked myself, what would I do differently if I was given his desk tomorrow, which admittedly, you know, is probably improbable. What would I do differently? And I really struggle to. I might not close the Green Brigade section necessarily, but, you know, I don't think I would turn it into a £120 million business overnight.
Yeah, it's difficult. So, as you guys are saying, we are constrained by the market we're in, and the market we're in is Scottish football, and the chance of us leaving that are pretty remote. So we should really just appreciate what we've got. That's really the core of what you're saying.
Enjoy our success, because we're successful on every dynamic, financial, non-financial, and I think from an operating capacity basis, frankly, our target should be to maintain rather than grow at this stage.
So you don't see Robin, so we're not going to get Google or Facebook on the front of the jersey?
I'd love to think that there is an opportunity at some stage where we will have some... we've got a greater chance of getting Google or Facebook than we have against Standard Life.
Mm-hmm.
Because Google, frankly, may not care. But, you know, we need to be a brand that understands the appeal of the Maverick and is therefore willing to tolerate the vagaries of some members of the supporter base and the odd piece of lunacy that comes out. And it's difficult to see who that Maverick is.
Ryan, yeah.
Well, I mean, the other question that comes up, because, I mean, to that point, I mean, I think there's more chance of seeing Robin's name in the front of his shirt than there is seeing Google. But, you know, the other question that comes up is, you look at King Power's relationship with Leicester, so there's a slightly fluid situation, as I understand, between the role as the owner and the role as the sponsor, and that's one of the ways I believe that the financial fair play rules can be flexed, because you know they can direct money in sponsorship or as the owner. But the other question that comes up is this kind of, you know, that's a Thai company, obviously, but you know, is there a Chinese investor or a Middle East investor that could be persuaded to you know to become an investor in Celtic, and would that shift the paradigm? And again, to that point, I think that the club has approached that as sensibly as they can. You know, they are taking steps into those markets in terms of commercial contact. You know, they try to use the appeal of the foundation. They try to use the appeal of sending Celtic trainers to run, for want of a better term, training camps in these countries. And, you know, I think they're playing a very sensible long game. And, you know, there is a sort of one in a million lottery chance that they will find, you know, some businessman in China that agrees to put 30 million of his...
Rangers, you know, found a diddy who would do it.
...dollars in.
Yes.
That was recently. That was £1 million. We read that. There are some Hong Kong based investors in Rangers who we're assured are in it because they believe they're going to make money in the transaction. And we know they're smart guys, but they're clearly much smarter than I am, because I'm not seeing that business model yet. But
can we talk just for a minute and just poke fun at them, because you know this firstly. The whole Craig White thing is this. I mean, it's a joy. It's a gift that just keeps giving. And Craig, I always thought Craig White did not go away. Craig White will somehow or other. Craig White is going to be the second guy to make money out of Scottish football after Gibbs. You know, whether he sold his debt or whether he retained some kind of phantom ownership, or whether or not he owns a stand at Ibrox or whatever the scenario is. Craig White will have done something for him and his backers that secures some future interest in Rangers that is going to become known and he's going to benefit from. But the madness of the Huns is that having gone through Charles Green and having gone into the Easdales and what have you, and now this current series of investors, they're all in it because they think they're going to make money. They remain financial investors.
Mm-hmm.
And coming back to your point a minute ago about what is success? Is success profit or is success trophies? You just cannot be, you know, a financial investor and win trophies. And you can't be a glory investor and make money. You know, and if we look back at Fergus's period, well, we won the league the season before he sold. And that was under extreme pressure, and Rangers wobbled quite badly in that season as well. You know, I'm not saying we got lucky, we were a great side.
No, I always remember that season because I got married at the end of the season and I was approaching it, and it was a season nobody wanted to win, because every time they drop points, we drop points and vice versa. So yes. You're spot on.
So the fact is, the Huns remain hijacked by these soldiers for fortune. You know, and I think, you know, their business model is the absolute antithesis of ours. You know, they're having to fund that business to the tune of 10 to 12 million a year because it's got cash flow deficits. And they are simply unable to cut their cloth. The other thing that I find fanciful is Mike Ashley has done a deal where he's benefiting from some future revenue stream and has forward dated his ownership and his participation. He's trying to think that, you know, Big Dave went down to see Mike and they've done a deal and a handshake and Mike's agreed to sell it.
Yeah, Mike said, it's all right, I know you're a dodgy guy, but I don't mind losing the odd time, so let's shake hands and I'll lose. People like him never lose.
No, I mean, I know people who know him and who have told me that this is the most ferocious operator you could ever imagine. So he remains involved. So the Huns are hijacked. They have embarked on a number of, you know, global searches for the vanity investor, you know, whether it be Jim McCall or Tom Hunter, you know, the West of Scotland guys, you know, whether it be through to, you know, the Arab Sheikh or the Chinese billionaire. The fact is that, you know, the Huns are hijacked forever until something happens that breaks them out of this mode. So, you know, coming back to the 10 in a row run, which I think we currently acknowledge is our holy grail.
Yeah.
There's no way that they are going to be released from these shackles this year or next year. You know, they may start to be able to trade their way out of it, but the ultimate irony, I'll get off my soapbox a minute, the ultimate irony to this is that I agree totally with what you said about managers, and they've had ditties.
Yeah.
I mean, what are they thinking? The manager of the fifth best team in Qatar, who goes and loses to the fourth best team in Luxembourg. I mean, diddies. You know, why in God's name didn't they just go and get Tommy Wright, who would deliver consistent second place performance in Scotland? Because they still think that they're box office and they've got delusions of mediocrity that are completely misplaced.
But you do not think that an important, you know, they've touted Rangers round the Far East. You know, I'm surprised you didn't get your door knocked back in January when they were out touting Rangers.
Yeah, we know people who did, and they found this guy that what's the guy, the Morgan Stanley guy, Alan? George Taylor, you know, who's a smart guy.
Uh-huh.
He was Taylor's son, you know, and you know, apparently, you know, is a core Hun through and through. And he's found this for this Julian guy.
I didn't realise he's Teddy Taylor's son.
Yes.
Did you know that Teddy Taylor, I don't know if he's still in the family, Teddy Taylor bought the name of Third Lanark when Third Lanark went bust.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, Teddy Taylor bought it to stop whatever, you know, it's all to do with property developer wanting to develop Kafkin Park, and Teddy Taylor bought it in the hope, I think because he was the local, I don't know whether his constituency covered it or bounded Kafkin Park, because obviously he was up further up at Cathcart, and Teddy Taylor bought the Third Lanark brand, so you can go and find out if George's family still own the brand.
Maybe that's the end game after all that I can never see. Maybe it's a cunning plan to rebrand Sevco as Third Lanark.
Maybe, yeah, bring back Third Lanark.
So, I think that, you know, you've got to look at the Huns and you've got to say, you know, what's it all about? And, you know, they're just going to remain in the shadows of this event. You know, I remember going at the Blue Room the night of the Joe Craig game, mm-hmm. you know, with a screamer. And this was the pinnacle of Scottish business establishment. My dad and I were guests in the Blue Room. And, you know, you just, you know, save of being in the headquarters of the Bank of Scotland, you know, you couldn't be anywhere more important.
And, you know, I could say anywhere more blue.
we'll gloss over what Robin was doing in the Blue Room. You know, I was going on the bus to the Broomlawn Road stand at the time, so we'll gloss over what he was up to in the Blue Room with his dad and Teddy Taylor.
But they are neutered, Harry. I mean, they are, you know, the exact opposite of us. And, you know, this is why, okay, you know, what do we need to keep spending? to remain dominant in Scottish football. And the reality is that that's why the current business model of maintaining at this level will consistently continue to deliver a level of dominance. You know, what will be interesting is if Aberdeen get to the group stages of the Europa League,
yes,
and they go from being an 8 million to a 15 to 20 million business, and then the Huns have got real, you know, consistent second club competition at their level. That will what will be much more interesting.
And Aberdeen don't have the infrastructure costs that Rangers have.
Exactly.
So they can push their turnover to not far from Rangers, but without the same level of financial burden and infrastructure costs. Actually,
let's not forget that at the moment it's aspirational for the club called Rangers to reach Aberdeen's footballing level.
Exactly.
That front of mind.
Do you not think as well that we, your point, Robin, about they're just touting Rangers as a money-making exercise to all these people, I'm sure we are page one of their sales pitch. Celtic's current share price. You can buy in at this level. We're as big as them. Look at their share price, because their share price just hit £1, which pushed us to £100 million.
Yes.
As the value of the business. So I'm sure that's how they're selling it.
Well, I have no doubt. But I mean, this operating deficit, you know, this 10 million. Now, you know, I think that the part of the Mike Ashley sleight of hand is by him relinquishing his shareholding directly, therefore the opposition to the rights issue where they could do the debt for equity swap is removed. So what's going to happen? If I was George Taylor and his cohorts, Harry, why would you want to own equity in a loss-making business?
Yep.
Your position is much better protected as a debt holder, because you can then control liquidation and bankruptcy than you can as an equity holder. You're just in with the other muppets that have bought shares. So I really see the Huns being paralysed by this, you know, for many, many years to come. And I think that's why we really have just got to focus on ourselves and recognise that, you know, in the fishbowl of Scottish football, if we can stay at 90, we'll have done marvellously well.
Alan, any comments on the Huns?
Well, other than laughing, I was saying to Robin earlier, I try not to think about the Huns. I mean, for many reasons, I try my best not to think about them, but I'm always reminded. I said to my dad in 2012, like many of us did, this is a gift that keeps on giving, and he's 87 and he can barely operate his phone, but I still get texts off him every few weeks going, you know, the gift that keeps on giving, Alan. So
Regardless,
the only thing that concerns me about them, there only is one thing, which is I actually believe that they have now a level of competence in management they didn't have before. And if they can ever get the buffoons who are in and around the club to actually leave management to manage, you know, I think they might get, you know, Stuart Robertson's a very competent football administrator, very sound chartered accountant background in insolvency, which won't do him any harm. I think there's an element that you know, at Rangers that is now competent and could help them to work their way out of it. But the beauty of it is, of course, the idiot shining moonbeams around them the whole time, right? I just thought they'd get left to do their job.
Do you know, someone was saying to me the other day, because obviously the chat about title stripping and that, he said, even, let's try and look positively on it, even if we don't manage to achieve the title stripping, go back 10 years when you knew there was something dodgy going on because the money that they were doing wasn't sustainable, but you didn't know what it was. Imagine finding out that actually there was something going on, and the consequences would be they would go bust, they would have to start again, they wouldn't even then successfully manage to rattle through the leagues, and then when they did get to the top flight, they couldn't even finish second place. They went through a whole load of diddies who tore them apart, and then they still, as you say, Robin, couldn't get a decent man, and 6-7 years down the line, they would still be nowhere near a threat to us. They would be in a battle between Hibs, Hearts and Aberdeen who's going to finish second, third and fourth. There is some joy to be taken from where we were 10 years ago.
This is why I'm less fixated on title stripping, Harry, because at the end of the day, we've won. We've won, and we've won the best way, because not only are they garbage and, you know, driven by these clowns, driven by self-interest and profit, we've done it our way. And we, more recently we've played great football and had a fabulous season. So it's not just that they've been garbage, we've been brilliant. So we have won. You know, and we're going to continue to win because of the structural nature of their troubles.
So we've won. Are we going to win the league this season? We've got the first game of the season on Saturday. Alan, your predictions for Celtic's trophy haul this season, your prediction for Saturday, and your prediction for the team on Saturday. Alan, first up.
I mean, it segues beautifully from what you just said. I mean, you start a season today and just think there's no scenario we won't win the league, right? It's only about how many points. I mean, I don't think we'll replicate last year. I'd be disappointed in less than 20 points. Cups are always a bit of a lottery, but yeah, I'd certainly be looking for the league and the cup this season. It's nice to have, talking of diminished Huns, it's nice to have a diminished Huns light to start the season as well. I was reading that Jamie Walker's out of the squad. Apparently his move from Huns light to Huns heavy might be on, so he's out for Saturday. Stephen Pressley, I see he's back in the frame now. Another little known fact was that Stephen Pressley was actually recommended by Robin for the Celtic job. I can't remember if it was before Strachan was appointed or Neil Lennon, but...
Did you have to? All right, Elvis.
Oh, and you know, that's the last thing. Alan's stream has just frozen over his Skype call. Maybe that's his last input into the podcast to land you in it.
I feel as if my credibility is there. What little there was is completely shattered. Listen, I'll pick it up while he dials back in. I think at least a 20-point gap. Do we want to wait until he redials, or do you want me to...
No, you carry on.
I think at least a 20-point gap. I think that certainly another treble is achievable, because we are so far ahead, and I think that our cup record is been tremendous of late. I think Champions League, I'm reasonably confident that we can get through, you know, based on the teams that we could play. You know, Astana, Karabag, those horrible trips, Beersheba, you know, they're a good side. They're probably the best team. You know, they beat Inter Milan. They knocked Southampton out. They're not a bad team.
Yeah.
I think on balance, we'll get in. The question is, well, frankly, I don't think we can focus on last 16. We've got, if we can get into the Europa League, if we can be playing European football after Christmas and all the excitement and the buzz associated with that, that's good enough, notwithstanding the absence of the riches of the last 16 of the Champions League. But I think that we're in great shape for another fabulous season. The one thing that worries me, and I'll just introduce a slight sort of question mark, is that Endon's recent signings, you know, Kouassi, Ncham, who's the other midfielder that he signed? Kumbaya. You know, the reality is, outside of Sinclair and outside of Dembele, Brendan's not been great in the transfer market. You know, we are still operating with a core that was Ronnie's team. You know, and if you look at it as this season, we're without Toure, we are without Roberts, because there's no way that he's coming back. So this boy in Cham's got to step up and got to be better. I think that Callum McGregor, we can keep him improving. He could be quite good, and he's maybe got a bit of the Patrick Roberts to him. You never know. But I've got very, very high hopes. And, you know, I think that, you know, the one thing that we've not talked about is the possibility of a Dembele transfer. And, you know, I know some people who are familiar with him who've told me that Dembele and his agent will manage this absolutely to their own advantage and to their own agenda. With, you know, just a passing reference to Celtic in that regard, and he'll do what suits him. So certainly for the moment it appears to be the case that it's going to suit him to stay, especially if we get into another Champions League campaign, because that will only, you know, improve his profile. So all is rosy, but some of Brendan's signings have got to come through and have got to show that they can add some value to the team.
So, Alan, we're going to get the treble, are we?
Well, cups are always difficult to predict, and certainly hope that we win the league by at least 20 points. And one of the cups, I think that's your minimum acceptable standard to be quite happy this year, is probably the Liga Cup and Champions League group. Yeah, I mean, there's still part of me that fancies a run at the Europa League. There's a part of me that fancies coming third in the Champions League group and then into the Europa League.
That's my favourite. Copenhagen have got more coefficient points than us because they don't play they get knocked out and play Europa League football.
Yeah, so I mean, absolutely. That's what success for me, I think, would be. We know how famous difficult trebles are to win, but league by 20 points, a cup, bit of a Europa League run, and. You know, I'd like to see the second best team in Scotland, you know, Aberdeen, get to, you know, roughly 20 points of us this season.
I have just received a text that tells me that we are now the highest seed in Pot 4, and if one of Seville, Napoli, Liverpool or Olympiacos get knocked out in the final qualifying round, we will be in Pot 3.
Yes,
that could be the difference.
You must know people I know, because I got the identical text about 3 hours ago.
Yeah, my son just sent it to me. And listen, I'm not sure. It probably does make a difference, because it means we'll get an easier game. We'll have one easier game. Listen, I think that we've just got to enjoy this. It's a marvellous time to be a Celtic supporter. And, you know, it won't always be this good. We've just got to enjoy every moment of it. And, well, you know, who's going to beat us domestically? Well, of course we're going to lose a game. We can't go through another season. But it's unlikely to be, you know, a big game. It'll be, you know, Kilmarnock and away Tuesday in November or something like that.
It will be. And do you know what? We will lose a game. It will be a massive story because Brendan's not lost a domestic game. So there's a part of me just wants it to happen relatively early into the season. Then it's over with and we can stop. Because the longer we go not losing a game domestically, then people start talking about, surely this team can't go two seasons. And it just starts to create pressure that's not needed.
But to your earlier point, how good is it to be having this conversation? You know, we're about to start the season and the conversation is about, you know, we probably will have to lose a game this year. You've got to just enjoy being alive as a Celtic fan at the moment. Oh, the other thing, just remember actually, the other reference point of my Celtic Clyde game in 75, I look back on it, there was 20,000 people at that game. So in 1975, there was 20,000 people turning up at Celtic Park. And I think there were probably a number of factors in that. One would be New Year's Day. But, you know, there's also, there comes a time when you've been so successful that you start to take it for granted. So the challenge for us all is to enjoy every minute of this, I think, including humping hearts on Saturday.
Well, and also, you know, the reality is that we can enjoy our unbeaten run, but we've also got a wee half an eye on Hibs and see how Lenny does. Because, well, if Commons does end up, you know, you look at Hibs.
Commons, Stokes, Ambrose, he's spoken to Mulgrew. It's Celtic reserves. It's the Celtic. It's the Celtic legends team. He's trying to put together.
if he can keep them fit and get them organised and motivated and get a bit of momentum, they're better than the Hunts. You know, one little gem after the Niederkorn game. You know, the Daily Ranger, you know, produced their player listings and gave them marks out of 10. And this guy Decio, who they signed from Benfica, was quoted as having had two games for Benfica last season. Actually, it was Benfica B. Wasn't even Benfica.
Yeah.
So they signed him. He got 1 out of 10. One. I mean, it's just, you know, and this is their big signing up front. I think that, you know, Pedro's a daddy, and that these guys, well, can you see them prospering in Scottish football?
No, and then the problem is when they sack Kashinia sometime between October and Christmas, they then have a team packed full of people who really, who were only came because another Portuguese guy brought them in, and they have really no desire to be there.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know what length of what contract duration they've got, but it's probably not, they're probably not there on 1 year deal.
No, it'll be 3-4 year deals probably, because their agents can ask for that.
Last season, I remember seeing a profile of their squad last year. It was roughly a third ending in 17, 18 and 19. So, they already had that problem before they went out and bought all these ditties.
Well, so we're going to... I'm going to bring this to a close. Quick one. Robin, scoring Saturday.
4-0.
Alan, scoring Saturday.
5-0.
Oh, excellent. With that, I will say Robin and Alan, thanks very much.
Diamonds are forever.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast, and I hope the boys are right about the score for the Hearts game. Many of you, by the time you're listening to this, will already know if they were right or not. Anyway, it gives us a good insight into the finance of the club, how they're doing, and what the chances are for growth, which obviously the reason for growth is all about just putting better players in the park. There'll be more podcasts along soon. We will hopefully have audio from the post-Hearts game press conference up, and we're probably going to have that transcribed and on the site as well, so if you can't listen or know someone who can't listen to podcasts, they can read about them. This is enough from me. That was Robin and Alan. They'll be on again on another day, and this is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless, and I'll leave you with James Bond in the background. Goodnight. To hurt me, I don't need love, for what good would love do me? Diamonds never liked me. To your grave.